In Dr. Zhivago, there's a scene where the young Pavel Pavlovich, he's a young radical full of vinegar and revolutionary spirit, and he is betrothed to a young 17-year-old who is named Lara. She's played by Julie Christie. And for complicated reasons, Lara is kind of under the protective care of an older gentleman by the name of Dr. Komarovsky. Dr. Komarovsky is in a relationship with Lara's widowed mother. You tracking with me? Okay. Pavel, Lara, Dr. Komarovsky. All right. They're engaged, Pavel and Lara. And Pavel and Lara meet at a cafe with Dr. Komarovsky because he kind of wants to do what uncles do. They kind of want to vet whether this marriage has got any staying power to it, right? So they meet. They're sitting there at this cafe, and the Dr. Komarovsky is sort of grilling this young couple about whether this marriage has any substance to it or the courtship. Meanwhile, Pavel was trying to defend himself that, yes, he might be young, and yes, he might be revolutionary, and yes, he might end up with a teaching post that is just barely adequate to provide for them, but it's going to be enough, by God. And so there ensues this little heated exchange, and where Dr. Komarovsky says to Pavel, "I hope you will not take offense, but you are very young." And Pavel looks him squarely in the eye and he says, "I hope you will not take offense, but is it true that you really improve with age?" And Dr. Komarovsky turns back and he says, "Yes, they become a little more tolerant." And then Pavel finishes off this little litany by saying, "Yes, because they have more to be tolerant in themselves." Yeah. The only thing thicker in that room than the tension is the cynicism. The doctor is what he thinks he's trying to see through this this edifice of great spirit, when in fact he thinks this boy is just simple impertinence incarnate. And Pavel looks back at the doctor and says, "You have no more wisdom about you. You're just a hack. You're just somebody that's trying to meddle in our affairs." But the cynicism is real. And they're both looking at each other as if to see through them and to say, "You are a fraud." And in that moment, it is reflective not only of the age in which they were in, but brothers and sisters, I would dare say it's reflective of the age that we're all in. This is a cynical age. Look, the presidential campaign kicked off this week, and I know that there is probably nobody on the planet that has ever said, "I can't wait, it's another political season, looking forward to it." Why? Because we all know that the whole political machine is undergirded by political machinations. If you want to be cynical, just become part of a family. It'll give you plenty of opportunities to kind of go, "Wow, what you purport to be is nothing of what it really is." And let's just be honest, brothers and sisters, you ever been part of a church? You've probably been tempted to cynicism. For all I know, you've listened to my words this morning to go, "Does he really believe that?" You wonder. We all do. And the thing about cynicism is, we can become so settled in it that it almost becomes an identity. Like, that's just who we are, right? Such that there's a quote on the front of your book by a guy named, on the front of your bulletin by a guy named Richard Keyes, or Keyes, who wrote a book called Seeing Through Cynicism, who said, "The genius of cynicism is that it is a voice in your ear that does not usually hang around long enough to be interviewed. It is usually expressed in innuendos, passing remarks, moods, cartoons, hints, insinuations, unacknowledged assumptions, and jokes." As if to say, the power of cynicism is in its subtlety and its pervasiveness and its cunning. As we conclude Lent this week, we are going to consider the moment when Jesus has entered into Jerusalem. And before the moment in the passage that we're going to read today, he entered to pomp and circumstance with palm branches and everything being laid down before him, because here's the king. He rides in humbly in a donkey. But by the moment that we're going to consider this day, there's still a question about his kingship. But it comes through the voice of one who looks upon him with a great deal of skepticism and cynicism, to the extent that this person, Pontius Pilate, is even cynical about whether there is such thing as truth. You and I feel that. You and I are tempted to that. You and I might have that identity. And the question is, What do we do with that cynicism? Jesus, in this passage, is going to confront Pilate about his cynicism in three ways. And I think that he will confront our cynicism in the exact same three ways. With his identity, by his integrity, and through his intimacy. With his identity, by his integrity, and through his intimacy. So let's see if that's true. We're in John chapter 18. If you'll stand, we'll read. John chapter 18, we're going to start in verse 28. And then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. So Pilate went outside to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they answered him, "If this man were not doing evil, we wouldn't have delivered him over to you." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves, judge him by your own law." And the Jews said to him, "It's not lawful for us to put anyone to death." This was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me? Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world." And then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" And Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." And Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. The moments that lead up to this moment happen so quickly. The language that is used is so spare and teeming with idiom that it's hard to make heads or tails, not only of what Jesus means in each of the encounters during this event, but also what he's trying to accomplish with the words that he chooses. But one thing is for certain and is not opaque. The arrest of Jesus on one level makes a pretty good case for cynicism. Judas sells him out. Those who are most knowledgeable in the law, who would be most likely to recognize Jesus as the Messiah, they seem the most hell-bent to silence him. Peter, Jesus' most trusted and courageous disciple, he turns his back. And so if you're looking for reasons to justify why cynicism might be appropriate in that day and in our day, you don't have to look any further than at Jesus' own experience. Appearances give way to reality, and things do not turn out as everyone had expected. And so as Pontius Pilate, with this superb succinctness, summarizes that case for cynicism with the famous comment, "What is truth?" It's an interesting thing to note that of all the officials that whom Jesus encounters, it's Pilate who is literally the poster boy for cynicism. That's the guy whom Jesus has the lengthiest and deepest exchange. And during that exchange, Jesus confronts Pilate's and our cynicism, first of all, with his own identity. See, there's a great deal of irony in those who bring Jesus to Pilate. At the same time that the Jewish authorities are trying to stack the deck against Jesus, skew the truth in whatever way they can to see about to a conviction, they're actually worried about infringing upon the ritual requirements of the rabbis that they stay out of the residence of a Gentile. Like, not coming in here, don't want to be ritually defiled, even though I'm working in a mendacious way to see to the murder of an innocent man. That's irony. They're egregiously suppressing some truth while fastidiously seeking to comply with some other lesser truth. They major in the minors and they fail at the majors. They take caution with the speck and are blind to the log. You ever done that? You ever seen that happen? Even the Jewish authorities, they recognize the flimsiness of their own case. They won't even specify to Pilate what he's done. They just say, would we have brought him to you if he's not a criminal? Trust us. Pilate sniffs it out. He knows they're dissembling. He knows that they're dispensing with the truth. And so he dispenses with the diplomacy by hauling Jesus into his headquarters. And he cuts to the chase and he says to Jesus, are you in fact the king of the Jews, in so many words? There's probably some curiosity in that question, but it's probably of the more wry kind. It's probably part of his cynical edge. But Jesus doesn't just let the comment lie there. He confronts it subtly by responding to a question with a question. And in so many words, Jesus asks, did you come up with that yourself, or are you just going off what you hear from other people? See, if it's the latter, then Pilate has bit on this misleading idea that Jesus is here to usurp political power. But if Pilate is just curious that Jesus may in fact have a kind of authority, then Jesus wants to fill him in on the whole story. He's not out to make conversation. He means to speak very clearly about this allegation that he's a king. He knows the mind of Pilate before Pilate knows himself. But in the question that he's asking Pilate, he's giving the governor an opportunity to set aside his cynicism, if only for a moment, and consider that actually appearances may belie reality, but not in a sinister fashion. Jesus is asking Pilate to be cynical about his own cynicism, to actually deconstruct his instinct to deconstruct things. Now, Pilate doesn't exactly fall in submission on his knees to Jesus. He almost couldn't care less. But is at least interested enough to ask the bewildering question, if you're really a king, then why are your own people turning you over to me as if you're a terrorist? And so Jesus explains the reasons for the incongruity, why present circumstances don't fit with the real identity that he is. He says in verse 36, my kingdom's not of this world. If it were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world. And so Jesus is saying two things. Yes, I am a king. He has a real authority and is worthy of genuine submission. And yet, on the other hand, no. He is not the kind of king that everybody thinks he is. He doesn't have the kind of kingdom that everybody thinks he's coming to usher in. His kingship, his kingdom, departs from what is conventionally known as power and rule in almost every other situation. His authority doesn't rest on his assertion. His authority doesn't proceed from the consent of the governed. His authority originates from what is not of this world. It originates from God. And as it is with his authority, so it is with his priority. What do I mean? His priority is not to come haphazardly replace one or many kings with himself for the sake of change itself, for the sake of being in power. He has come to make a new people by changing them from the inside out, who will then willingly, not slavishly, look to him as a king. And when it comes to the manner in which he will establish his rule, it could not be more different from how conventional kings establish their rule. He's not come to conquer with power. He's come to be conquered. He's come to let his preferred mode of exercising power not be through the will to power, but through sacrifice. He's different. And therefore, he says in his many words, hey, Pilate, I am king, but not like the ones you know. He is confronting Pilate's cynicism subtly by inviting him to consider that Jesus may in fact be more than his cynical conception allows. Now, that's the story. What does it matter to yours and my temptation to cynicism, or let's just say our struggle with cynicism? why would Jesus' identity as a king serve to confront cynicism in you and me? He's obviously making a claim about his authority. And though his kingship differs from the kings that originate here in all the ways he's mentioned, Jesus is not calling us to a lesser allegiance to him. He's calling us to a greater allegiance to him. And I doubt anybody in this room who thinks of themselves as a Christian would ever explicitly say that they cynically deny Jesus' authority over him. Nobody would say that. Nobody would say, I don't trust them. No way. But brothers and sisters, you and I can still operate with a functional cynicism. You and I can act cynically even if we're not aware of it or at least won't admit to it. And we can do that in a number of ways. Publicly, we can voice our allegiance to authority and wave our palm branches. But we can, in the next breath, silently dismiss the reality of his authority. How do I know? Let's consider a few examples. You ever been in a dispute with somebody? When you were, did you ever pause to consider the mind of Christ on it? Did you ever pause to ask for insight or humility before you launch forth in trying to bring clarity or justice to the issue? Are those your instincts? If Jesus is really your king, then his insight and his input are going to have a place in your reconciliation. They always will. You ever been in a pinch? You ever rear up in a fit, guns blazing, arms flying? Or are you the person that prefers to cower in the fetal position? You know what's common to both of those expressions? They're both premised on the underlying belief that it's all up to you. If Jesus is king, then his authority serves either to cool your jets or to calm your soul. What about in your sorrow? If Jesus is king, then as surely as that king whom we know mourned at the tomb of Lazarus, as surely as we know that he did that, then to believe him as king is certainly to be mournful when it's proper. But mourning, if he's the king, is also reasonably tempered, given that king's power over things, including death. How you respond in moments like that, and we could reproduce any number of them, scads of them, that reveals the degree of cynicism that you have towards his authority and his identity. Pilate looked cynically upon Jesus' claim to authority, and we can too. Now, anybody can claim to be a king. It wasn't so many years ago that a guy fired a gun at the White House claiming to be the modern-day incarnation of Jesus. And he even made a video and sent it to Oprah making that claim. Why he had to send it to Oprah, I don't know. But part of our cynicism revolves around the belief that anyone who makes a truth claim can't be trusted. And so, why not be cynical about somebody who claims to have kingly authority or identity? That's the second part of Jesus' challenge to both Pilate and our cynicism. He challenges it with his identity, but he also challenges it by his integrity. We can tell from Pilate's language that he is mostly exasperated with what he perceives to be this little intramural squabble among the Jews. And he tries to get himself out of the whole fracas by saying it's outside his jurisdiction. Roman law had no place, no say in religious matters of the land that it occupied because Roman law didn't care. But at least part of Pilate's interest in Jesus is that Jesus' claim to authority may in fact have everything to do with politics, not just Jewish politics. And so when Jesus admits to being a king, albeit of an unconventional sort, Pilate is going to press him on the matter and he says, so you are a king. And again, the specter of an attempted political coup may be within Pilate's question. But without flourish or long speech, Jesus, with no recrimination either, he explains his purpose for coming as a king. It's not a purpose that most kings of that day or any day have in mind for their respective reigns. What Jesus says about his own kingship is this. He came to rule and to exercise that rule in part by testifying to what is true. not to establish a rule, enslave his subjects, and live off their labor, not create a nation and then expand it for the sake of expanding it, not letting naked ambition drive an imperialistic crusade interested in territory. Jesus came to exercise rule by testifying to the truth. Now, to catalog all the truth that Jesus came to bear witness to, can't do it. John says as much at the end of this gospel account. There aren't enough books in the world that could contain everything that he came to disclose. But there's at least two things about the content of Jesus' truth that stand out in this passage. One is this. His purpose for his life wasn't something that just sort of came over him. It was something that he did not derive from a spiritual gifts test. His purpose was preordained long before he walked the earth. And we get that from what he says intriguingly in this redundant phrase, "For this purpose I was born, for this purpose I have come into the world." He understands himself as one who exists not just as the result of a conception, but as one who has been dispatched by no less than God the Father himself. That's part of the truth he came to testify to. The other part goes back to his identity. To testify to the truth doesn't merely mean sharing bare facts, rattling off little lectures about God, man, sin, grace, and faith. When Jesus speaks of bearing witness to the truth, it's more than disclosing facts. It's disclosing himself. And what he's disclosing of God is not just in the form of words, but in his very self. He testifies to the truth because he himself is the way, the truth, and the life. And so as one commentator puts it, when Jesus speaks of testifying the truth, he is in part meaning that he's the fulfillment of what's been anticipated. Much work remains to be done in God's plan to restore the world, but Jesus is the culmination, the completion of God's plan to reconcile the entire creation to himself. Jesus is truth with a capital T. Now, by ruling as a king, by telling the truth, that might sound like, wow, that's the best you've got? You've come to be a king by telling the truth. Well, what else? But friends, how many examples could we rattle off of those with power that exercise power just for the sake of preserving that power, and often by not telling the truth? How many exercise that power for the sake of preserving that power by doing everything actually they can to conceal the truth? I mean, is just this week, one congressman resigns in the wake of an ethics scandal, and another senator is indicted on charges about ethics, about concealing the truth. And when that happens, what happens? The seedbed for cynicism just got another seed, just got a little bit more cultivation. What's more compelling about Jesus' interest in ruling through truth-telling is that he's about to die for the truth that he came to speak. And he's not trying to wriggle out of the clutches of those who either despise him, misunderstand him, or would just as soon be done with him. He walks into it, and he knows what's coming, and he doesn't care. Jesus challenges Pilate's cynicism about the truth by first not failing to represent that truth, but then also entrusting himself to his Father who sent him to tell the truth. And then refusing to lash out when it seems like the truth is about to be suppressed. He takes the blows. And in so doing, he actually ensures that the truth gets told. When we conceal the truth, when we skew the truth for our own purposes, and particularly when we're not content with simply telling the truth, it turns out more of a defense of ourselves than of the truth. And when we do that, we're being cynical toward the truth. It's as if one person said it, we can't handle the truth. But Jesus confronts the cynicism about our truth by first telling it and then dying to tell it. And then calling us to entrust ourselves to his care. And then calling us to tell the truth in love. His integrity challenges our cynicism toward the trustworthiness of anyone telling the truth. Which leads me to my last point. We've said he confronts cynicism with his identity and also by his integrity, but Jesus will also and always confront our cynicism in the context of intimacy. Now, what am I getting at there? It might sound almost like an afterthought or a passing comment or just a turn of phrase that had no meaning to it. But when Jesus says to Pilate in verse 37, "Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." When he says the word "of," it means something. He's getting at the nature of truth itself. The choice of phrase is not arbitrary. One does not merely know the truth. One is of the truth, Jesus says. So familiar with it, so reflective of it, and all because you've been so moved by it that you've been shaped by it. To know the truth to which Jesus testifies is almost to belong to that truth, to almost hail from that truth as surely as you might hail from Duncanville or DeSoto or Arlington or Dallas or Maypearl or Waxahachie or wherever you come from. The truth to which Jesus testifies is different from the truth about multiplication tables. The latter you can know, but you don't have to engage them in the same way. You can know what 8 times 7 is, but it will never engage you like knowing what it means that God came to earth in human form to reconcile us to God. It's a different kind of truth, even though both are truth. What's different is that something is the voice of Christ himself, a kind of communion with him in which you don't just comprehend ideas he expressed, but you are moved by them and compelled to act in response to them. He came as a king to testify to the truth so that you and I would come to love both him and the truth he brings, to be of the truth so that we're shaped by it because of our confidence in the one and of his love who came to share it and die for it. That's what it means to listen to his voice, to recognize it. It implies a trust that exists between those who hear him and him who speaks. So how really does that confront our tendencies toward cynicism? I think if you're honest, you would acknowledge this truth. Deep down in the recesses of your cynicism, there is a pain that you sought to cover over. Appearances gave way to reality in your life, and you were left nursing wounds of disappointment and tragedy, and therefore cynicism may have been your only chosen way, the only way you thought you could to avoid the pain of disappointment that comes from seeing the true nature of what we thought we understood. Jesus sought to confront Pilate with his few words, but the only thing that would ever really displace his cynicism and would displace ours is what he would do after his encounter with Pilate. To become the king he would be, to fulfill the truth to which he'd come to testify, to make the truth so penetrating for us, he would have to die for us. So that what separated us from God would be removed. So that we would know deep down that God at the bottom of God is love. So that you and I could live with, not with cynicism, but with an actual expectation that God is for us. That expectation, that confidence only comes through a kind of communion with God himself, an intimacy that he establishes with us and nurtures in us. It doesn't inoculate us against pain. It doesn't insulate us from tragedy. But it does allow us to hope and trust and love, even when our experience might tempt us to cynicism. Nothing short of the gospel will ever consistently dislodge your cynicism. And that's what I think is the application of this passage, if you'll let me to close now. Cynicism leads you to think that nothing is as it claims to be. And where cynicism is deepest, where it has the tightest stranglehold on your soul, there is no appetite for risking anything for love's sake. Why risk? Why love if it's only going to prove to have been worthless in the end? That's where cynicism will take you, and that's where you can end up living for a very long time. Jesus risked all for love. He did more than simply tolerate what was in us. He gave of himself to see what was intolerable in us to be made beautiful. and hopeful and full of love. And given what he risked for love, why he did so, and what came of what he did, brothers and sisters, let me say this. You will never be the fool for having risked something for the sake of love, even if it didn't accomplish what it sought. He was no fool to risk everything for your good, and neither shall you be for another or for him. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.